The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
To me, it confirms what we've known for months, which is that Fauci lied to us. He lied to Congress. He knew that our taxpayer dollars were being administered by his organization to third parties like EcoHealth Alliance to do cooperative research, gain-of-function research at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. And when questioned about it, he hid behind a highly legalistic definition. But more to the point, he was lying. We now have the 90-day intelligence review from the Biden administration, which came back with nothing.
Yep.
That's unacceptable. And it said that we can't get to the bottom of this until we have the cooperation of the Chinese. That is bogus.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew Mariani and taking your calls today at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. That audio was from Representative Mike Gallagher. We talked about the NIAID, NIH studies that were uncovered by The Intercept on a Freedom of Information Act demand in the first hour. So if you missed that conversation, go to relevantradio.com and just download that podcast from our first hour. You'll catch up with what we had to say on that, and hope that you enjoy that conversation. By the way, coming up an hour from now is Cale Clark, The Seven Sorrows and Seven Joys of Mary. So be sure to stay tuned after the top of the hour for Cale Clark. Now we're going to turn our attention to the upcoming anniversary of 9/11, the events in Afghanistan over the past few weeks, in terms of how they impact the veterans of that war, and especially the ones who are already struggling with their experiences in service. And joining us to discuss that is Gretchen Smith. She's a military veteran whose father died after dealing with PTSD. She had to act after that and developed Code of Vets, which you can follow on Twitter at Code of Vets, which is there to support veterans who are dealing with suicidal thoughts. With this being the Suicide Prevention Weekend, all that is happening in Afghanistan and 9/11, of course, coming up on the weekend. A lot of veterans are really in need of this kind of help. Since the beginning of the year, social media censorship, the ability of this group to reach out to vets has been hampered. And Gretchen is here to talk a little bit about that and just a lot more about where our veterans are at. Gretchen, thank you so much for being here today.
I am so grateful you are having me on the show, Ed. It's such an honor to be able to share our mission with you.
Well, and it's very much an honor to be able to share it with our listeners. And I mean, this is going to be a tough week. It was going to be a tough week anyway. I mean, the 20th anniversary of 9/11 was coming up. That's a tough anniversary for Americans to deal with, regardless of whether they've been in the service. But with the collapse in Afghanistan and the end of the way the mission has ended in Afghanistan and the outcome there, it really has to have had a tremendously negative impact on veterans who did their best and upheld the mission just as well as they possibly could, regardless of how the government did the same. I mean, it's a very frustrating period of time here, and it can't be any. Veterans must be feeling it harder than anybody.
It is a very complex time in the veteran community. Emotions are raw, running high, rampant, all over the place, you name it. You know, and as they've come back and reintegrated back into society, and that could be another conversation if we have time to dig into it, it's difficult. That transition from military to civilian life is difficult. So, you know, we've got veterans who are in those moments right now. So for them to be transitioning, we're actually helping some veterans who are, you know, Afghan vets now and new, you know, just out of the military, and they're watching all of this unfold along with the rest of us. And it just weighs on them heavily. And as they're trying to adjust back to life, but they're looking, you know, back over there to see it all fall apart. And, you know, when they begin to question, what did my service matter? Did the sacrifice matter? I watched one of my buddies, you know, be blown up by an IED. That, you know, there's just so many different things that are going through their minds that they're sharing with us as they come through our system. And it's, you know, it's overwhelming for us. So, you know, we just let them know that they're not alone and that their service did matter and that, you know, what they did because of 9/11 has kept us safe on our own soil for so many years. So we just need to remind our veterans out there, especially during this time with the anniversary just in a few days, it's what you have done has made an incredible impact on our nation, and it has kept that from happening again. And that's what I continue to tell them over and over again. And again, with the struggles they bring back home with them, with PTSD, TBI, other issues, it just, oh my gosh, Ed, the load is very heavy right now. And my partner and I, Dr. Cindy Walter, we've been carrying an incredibly heavy load with them, trying to alleviate some of the stressors and pressure that they're under, and getting them the help that they needed as we find the issues.
Gretchen, do you mind talking a little bit about your father and how you came to launch Code of Vets? I mean, this is obviously, you're a veteran yourself, so you already have some insight into this. But you know, your experience with your father is obviously what's been motivating you. And if you're comfortable with that, I'd love to hear a little
Absolutely.
Bit about your father.
Absolutely, it ties right into what's going on with the suicide surge in our community. You know, my dad was a Vietnam veteran, airborne infantry. He came home a shattered spirit, and, you know, I've spoken with my family at length about Dad, and they all just, you know, the common thread was he came back different. You know, he just was a different spirit, a different soul, and he just was out of control. And he did reach out at one point early on after he had gotten back from war, and he had gone to the Asheville, North Carolina VA, and told them, you know, he just said, basically, I'm going to end up dead or in prison. I'm not, you know, I can't control myself. And he was explaining to what his, you know, his symptoms were, you know, certain things were triggering him. And the doctor sat him down and told him he had something called shell shock, and that he basically needed to shove it way down deep and never speak of it again, that he needed to suck it up and be a man. And Dad did that. That he was a soldier. He followed orders. He did two tours, and ended up being awarded a Bronze Star. But his life was so troubled, Ed. He just was up and down. Never could find peace or stability in his life. And before he died, I sat down with him, and I was crying, and I said, Dad, what are you doing? You know, we need you. Your grandkids need you. And he just looked at me with these big tears in his eyes, and he just said, Gretchen, I'm tired. I'm done. And he said, they've won. And he said, I can't do this anymore. He said, I'm ready to go home. And it just, the look in his eyes, he was so broken. And I just took those words. We couldn't save that. We couldn't save Dad. And we lost him. And I just took those words and, you know, tucked them away in my heart. And I had to raise my kids. They were young at the time. And now that they're grown, I started Code of Vets. It was a Twitter page, because I needed to do something to honor my dad, because you know what? Right. His life mattered, and his service mattered, and his struggle mattered. I wanted to share it from a daughter's perspective. I am a veteran too, but I wanted to do it as his daughter. And in 2017, I started, you know, Code of Vets Twitter page, and it exploded from day one. Veterans really gravitated to it because it's such a heart journey, and many of them have been down that same path that Dad was on and struggled with alcohol. You know, just bursts of anger and, you know, just feeling out of control, and not knowing the resources that were out there for him, because he wouldn't open up and ask for help and talk about it after he had been shut down early on.
You know, Gretchen, I think I'm not a veteran, so I'm talking about this from the perspective of an outsider. You know, my father is a veteran. My father-in-law has long since passed away, but he's a veteran of World War II in Korea. My father's still with us, and he's a veteran of Korea. And what I think that the value in Code of Vets and other veteran-based organizations is that there is a greater comfort value for people, for veterans to come to other veterans, because
right.
Those of us who aren't veterans, we just lack the context, and it's too complex for us to have it explained to us. You know, and I talk with my father about this. My father is, you know, doing fine. But, you know, I mentioned to him, I said, you know, you never really talk about what happened in Korea. He says, because I don't want to talk about my combat experience with people who weren't there, just don't understand
right.
it. And
right.
and that's very common. And so I think Code of Vets, and by the way, at Code of Vets is where you can find the Twitter page. I'll keep on to emphasize that, where you can find out how you can help. that's the reason why it really takes other vets to do this, I think, because that is the opening that so many men and women who are struggling with this need. They need to know that the people who are on the other side already have that context.
Yeah, you're right. There's a camaraderie there, a brotherhood that it's difficult to describe unless you've been in the military and experienced it on a day-to-day basis. And it's powerful, and it is very healing for the veterans to find each other and to be able to talk amongst themselves and to find strength in each other. And that's why, I love to partner with other vet orgs so that when I do have a suicidal vet that comes our way, you know, we'll do a quick assessment. Can we get them through those moments? Because a lot of times all they do is need to talk through those dark moments. But if it's something more and they need, you know, to be in residential treatment or, outpatient therapy, whatever the case may be, you know, we've got orgs in place that are, that are there for veterans that are run by veterans, which is incredible. And that's where you find the biggest success, because you're getting help from peers, from somebody who's been there and done that, and you don't have to try to sit there and explain. They get you. And a lot of them have been on that path themselves.
Right.
There's an incredible org out in Houston, Camp Hope. It's PTSD USA, I believe, and they are phenomenal. They only deal with combat trauma, and I try to gear and, or send as many vets as I can who are really struggling, that need some residential assistance long term, their way, because I tell you what, combat vets, helping combat vets, Ed, that's the answer. We can reduce the number of suicides in our veteran community by helping each other.
And again, you can go to Code for Vets Code of Vets at Code of Vets on Twitter to find out more about this. Now, I understand that there's been some problems though in the social media sphere for you guys, that you've been having some problems keeping the access to this. Tell us a little bit about what's going on in social media with your organization.
Yeah, we are very unique in the fact that we are 100% social media run, and I've basically raised all of our funds, $5 million, which we need to touch on in a little bit, from the Twitter page. So Twitter removed, believe it was 81,000 followers from me in a period of a very short time in January. And that devastated our organization, because that's where I raise funds for the missions. That's where we do our just our buddy checks. A lot of our elderly vets who are housebound or just, don't get out much, or veterans who do not have a good support system in their lives, they have found their way to Code of Vets, and we have become family. And so I lost track of countless vets, thousands of vets, especially some of my older ones who would check in with me periodically. I would check in with them. I have no idea what happened to them. I had one of my elderly vets one night who was, he had been drinking. He had sent me a picture with a gun to his head. But guess what? He needed to know that he mattered. He needed to know somebody gave a damn about him. And I was able to just walk him through those brief moments and get him on the other side of that. And a lot of the times that's all veterans need. And I have no idea what happened to him. Twitter removed his account. So it's what they did is, I can't even describe it, because we were saving lives. We were giving them, a family support system in an informal way. And there's no telling the damage that they've caused by removing all of those counts within such a short period of time. And the suppression, there's censorship. Some of my tweets will just sit there and they won't get out there. And we're trying to raise money for a veteran who's sitting in a car or in a hotel. And that these guys have suicidal ideation when they're at their low. This is a way for them to know, hey, not only does my country care about me, but my veteran community has not forgotten about me. They're taking the time out of their day to share the information about me, to get me back on track so that I can pay it forward. And that's how a lot of them feel. They tell us we are going to pay it forward when we get back on our feet. And a lot of them will donate to Code of Vets in the future, which is awesome. That's how we want it to be.
Right.
But, big tech really put a hurting on us. And there's such a human connection with what we do, even though it's social media. And I don't think that they understand truly the damage that they cause when they censor us and when they suppress us and when they remove accounts from us.
We're speaking with Gretchen Smith of Code of Vets. You can also go to codeofvets.com, codeofvets.com. In fact, that's where you can go to donate and find out how else you can help out. Also taking your calls at 888-914-9149 if you've got any questions for Gretchen or myself on this. Gretchen, what was the reason that Twitter took all these accounts away? I mean, it's just, I know that they go through, you know, some bot purges from time to time. And I collect bots that follow me. And from time to time, I'll lose a couple thousand followers. And I figure either I've irritated somebody or a whole lot of somebody.
Yes.
Which is, by the way, a very rational explanation for this. Or Basically, they've just been clearing out the bots. But I mean, I've never seen anything on that scale. And I mean,
no, 81,000 is not clearing out the bots. There's more to it than that. That's why, and I'm a Southern girl. I have, I'm conservative at heart. I try to keep that outside of Code of Vets on my, on that page. It's for veterans. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. I'll take your money if you're Democrat or Republican, or I'll help a veteran. That's not one of the questions we ask a veteran, so we have no idea what their affiliation is, nor do we care. But Twitter, they know I'm conservative at heart. So I really do believe it's a form of punishment, that it's a form of, keeping us in check when we do get out of line or say something that does not fall in line with, what Twitter thinks we should be saying, which is a disgrace, because we've served, especially everyone that follows me on Code of Vets, most of us are veterans, and we've served with that freedom of speech. And all Americans, we all have that right to speak out our voice, whether you like it or not, doesn't matter. The point is we all have, if that's what makes our country so unique and beautiful, are the freedoms that we have. And to have these companies out there deciding, picking and choosing who is going to have a voice and who is it, or we're going to stomp on their voice and suppress it. Little do they know, when they do minimize the voice of a veteran org out there, that they're harming. They're causing real harm, and that's what the message I want to get across is that we are saving lives in the process. We are giving veterans hope. We are motivating them to keep stepping forward in life, and we're offering resources to them to make sure that they get stabilized when they find themselves in desperate situations. But yeah, they shouldn't. There is no way, there is no justification for 81,000 to be removed in a period of roughly 4 to 5 days. It's insane. I've never, it's I definitely felt like a punishment to me, because, I've also been locked out of my account for 12 hours for something that I've said. And it's just, you feel like you're 5 years old. It's like, there's no point in it. We all need to be able to speak freely, as long as we're not causing harm to someone. I really believe that we need to honor our freedom of speech.
Well, absolutely. I mean, Code of Vets is doing really great work here. I can't imagine why Twitter or anybody else would want to interfere with that. Fortunately, you do have the website, codeofvets.com, just in case that happens. But the connections are made on social media, and that's where people find out about this. And I'm glad you're here today, because we can direct people to both, at Code of Vets on Twitter. Codeofvets.com is the website. Now, tell us a little bit about the fundraising, what it is that you and your group are looking to raise now, and what you're hoping to do.
Well, right now we have roughly about 51 veteran families in the system who are at risk for homelessness. And a lot of these veterans are 9/11 first responders and Afghan vets. So, some of them are being evicted. We've got utilities disconnects. We've got foreclosures. So those are the types of situations we deal with really serious situations and vets in serious need. So that's what we're pushing out there. That's what we're raising funds for. I put the veterans out one at a time. We show a picture of them just to kind of make a heart connection with the donor. I put a brief synopsis of what the need is, and it works. It's efficient. My partner, Dr. Cindy Walter, she vets the veterans. She puts together case management plans for those who have multiple issues in their life and that need some guidance. We will not just hand money to veterans. That, we have to know that there's a path forward to stability if we give them the funds for security deposit, for first month's rent, utilities, that kind of thing. and she does a phenomenal job. She's been doing this for years. The woman's a genius. But anyway, it works. It's something nobody's ever done it before. It's kind of like we're blazing a new path of, you know, fundraising. We can operate on 2% because it's social media based. We work from our homes. We're volunteers. So almost all of the money, you know, with the exception of the 2% operational budget, is getting directly into the hands of the veterans. But the even more beautiful thing about it, Ed, is that it's happening in real time. As the veterans are coming through, filling out the vet need form on the Code of Vets website, Cindy is vetting them. And then once she says, you know, they are legit, she sends them to me. I raise the funds. And they will, in turn, send us a receipt for that whatever they've paid, whether it's their utilities disconnect notice or their eviction. You know, if they're 2 or 3 months behind on rent, we'll raise that for them. And they'll send us a screenshot of what they've sent, and I'll post it out there. You know, the money I've sent, then I'll post out something they've sent to me, a screenshot of the bill paid. And the donor gets to see it all in real time unfolding, and it's just a phenomenal way to feel like you're really part of something. You're making a true difference in that veteran's life in the moment when they really need it the most.
And again, you can go to codeofvets.com and be part of that. Also follow Gretchen and Code of Vets at Code of Vets on Twitter. And Gretchen's on Twitter as well. And I just followed her while we were talking, actually. It's that easy to follow Gretchen. Gretchen, can you, and it's already flown past because so many people are retweeting the announcement that you're going to be on the show here. Your Twitter handle is at COV underscore Gretchen.
Yes, that's my personal. That's where I can be my conservative self. Take my hat off, so to speak.
Well, there you go.
You know, just, you know, let it all hang out.
That's
all
right.
You know, what's on my mind. Yeah, and we all need a place to be able to do that. But again, I try to keep those two separate. But
absolutely.
If, you know, you would love to follow me on at COV underscore Gretchen. Oh, yeah, I like to get out there and interact with everybody. And it's good for us to, you know, just as Americans to be out there. Social media can be a beautiful thing, and it can be a fun way for us all to interact. But it also can be a place where it can be, you know, evil, and we just have to, you know, watch each other's back because there's people out there who are, you know, are scammers and who do not have our best interest at heart. And so we can monitor, you know, just because I've been out there long enough to where I've got a good eye for who's scamming and who's, you know, who's being honest and truthful. So I love doing that for people who are not sure. They'll come to me and they'll be like, hey, you know, what do you think about this account? And I've, you know, been able to give some advice on that. But anyway, back to the Code of Vets, it's been a God thing. This journey it's been powerful. We have raised, just this month, we touched the 5 million, or we surpassed the 5 million donation milestone, which is huge for a grassroots org like us. You know, yeah, we have no brick and mortar. We don't have a staff. It's, you know, my partner and I. We do have a, you know, 2 or 3 other volunteers that do some smaller things for us. But it's basically Sandy and I out there all day, every day, you know, amongst the vets, doing as much as we can 7 days a week. It's our passion, and we enjoy doing it. And it's and I think our paycheck is when we get a phone call from a veteran just to hear the gratitude in their voice to say, you just don't know. You just don't know what you've done for me, you know, or you've given me hope, or, I can't wait to be able to pay it forward. Some of them get really excited. So it just... I love seeing that and knowing that we're, you know, empowering them, and just in a moment where they're at their weakest, and just saying, hey, we're here for you. We've got your back. You know, we've got you covered. You were there for us. Now, it's, you know, it's our time to be here for you.
Gretchen Smith, we're going to have to leave it at that, but go to codeofvets.com, at codeofvets on Twitter. Find out how you can help. Gretchen Smith, thank you so much. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Drew Mariani is here for you on Relevant Radio.
It's 30 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew today and taking your calls. Don't forget to stay tuned at the top of the hour for Cale Clark. He'll be discussing the seven sorrows and seven joys of Mary. It's going to be a great show. That starts at the top of the hour at 5 p.m. Central Time. Be sure to stay tuned. Now we're going to turn our attention from veterans who clearly are going to need some support this week. And I want to thank again Gretchen Smith for being with us to discuss CodeOfVets.com. We're going to talk about the draft. Should there be a draft? And if there's a draft, should that include women? This is a really hot topic on Capitol Hill this summer, and somewhat surprisingly so, because I thought that this had more or less been passed off to a commission a few years ago. And usually in Washington speak, that means we're going to pass it off to a whole bunch of people that nobody's going to pay attention to, and the issue will die on its own. Apparently that's not the case, and here to discuss this is Elaine Donnelly, who's the founder and president of the Center for Military Readiness, an independent public policy organization that specializes in military personnel issues. You can find them online at cmrlink.org. She has served as a member of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services and was appointed by President George H.W. Bush to the Presidential Commission on the Assignment of Women in the Armed Forces. Elaine, welcome to the show. Great to have you with us.
Hi, nice to talk with you, Ed.
Now, Elaine, I mean, normally this is what happens, right? Congress starts kicking around something that's controversial. The hornet's nest explodes. They decide to pass the thing off to a commission that will issue a report that gets buried, you know, somewhere in the archives, and nobody ever pays attention to this anymore. That didn't work in this particular case. This issue has come back. The idea of putting women in the draft has come back.
Mm-hmm. Not this commission. This commission was a rather powerful body. $45 million spent on this commission over three years. They have issued recommendations that are becoming part of law as we speak, with almost no public attention or debate or consideration of what it would mean to do what this commission has recommended and what some members of the House and Senate are putting into the National Defense Authorization Act for 2022. We'll call it the defense bill for short.
Sure.
The NDAA. Not only would the language already passed on the Senate side, in the Senate committee, offered by Senator Jack Reed, he would change the words male citizens under selective service law to all Americans. All right, so there's the change that includes young women for the first time in our history. But in the Senate side, the Senate version of the defense bill is a provision that the National Commission recommended. My organization has been screaming about this for years, and people are still not paying any attention. What does it mean to say that for 2 years, everybody in the United States should work for the government, at the direction of the government? We don't have a Chinese social credit system. But under what is being proposed and being written in law this year, we could very well end up where you don't have a presumption of liberty and freedom. You have a presumption of service to the government. Now, I hasten to add, we're all for volunteerism. We like to see volunteers. Volunteers, it's a very popular thing to do. It's a very American thing to do, to volunteer.
Right.
But this is different. This is national service directed by a government bureaucracy, which would have a name similar to the commission. It would become not the National Commission. It would be the National Council on Military, Public, and National Service. And it would be cabinet level. It would commandeer the lives of young people. You could, and you'll have a so-called choice. Actually, it's not much of a choice. You
right.
can either serve in the military or do something else the government directs you to do. Now, mind you, this would not include working with a pro-life group or the kinds of organizations that don't meet with the approval of the great woke powers that be that we see in charge these days. It means the kind of service only to organizations approved by the federal government. So this is a radical change. It's not being debated. They didn't have hearings on this, but it's being done incrementally, one step at a time. If you pass first Draft Our Daughters legislation to include young women, and then you change the definition or the meaning of selective service, what you've done is open the door to government-mandated service for any reason, not just the reason of fighting to defend America in a time of catastrophic a peril, an attack on the United States, or something that would require reinstating a military draft. What this language would do is open the door to, well, the government can order you around for any particular reason at any particular time. And it's really quite radical, and it's in the defense bill that just passed earlier this week in the House, but it won't be there won't be a floor vote in both the House and the Senate until later in the month.
You know, it's interesting, Elaine, because I when this did pop up, I wrote about this, it must have been 2 or 3 weeks ago now, maybe a little bit longer ago than that. And I was under the impression that this might be just a sort of a backdoor effort to finally repeal the Selective Service System. I mean, this is, we haven't had a national draft since, you know, Vietnam.
Long time.
Right. It's almost 50
there
years.
There is legislation pending to do just that. I don't think that is really going anywhere. The commission did not endorse that idea. You could make a case for it. It's not been used. But we live in a perilous world. Selective service is a relatively low-cost insurance policy. If it's needed to call up great numbers of people to mobilize them quickly and train them quickly, then selective service certainly could come in handy. Now, they've made some recommendations. I don't have a problem with updating the system, making it more, I guess, savvy in the computer world that we have now, social media and things like that. That's not the problem. But if you say that the purpose of selective service is changed, it's not for the purpose of replacing those who have died on the battlefield, combat replacements.
Right.
That's the purpose of selective service. I know that sounds very callous, but if you think about it, the only time selective service was ever activated or a draft was when people were dying on the battlefield and the military needed people to replace them, and people were called up, and yeah, it was hugely controversial, certainly during Vietnam, and that is as it should be. We shouldn't be sending young men and women to war unless there's a very good reason. Okay, but selective service makes it easier sometimes, as it did in Vietnam. Oh, we'll just call up, you know, several thousand more troops, and off they go. That went on that way for many, many years. But that's another debate, really, whether there should be any selective service at all. What we're talking about here in calling up or registering young women is really quite a revolutionary concept. Now, just imagine how this would work. If there's something, a catastrophic national emergency beyond the capability of the all-volunteer force, okay, and we all support the all-volunteer force. If selective service does what is required here for reasons of equity, equal numbers of men and women, guess what? The system is totally jammed because only a very small number of women would be physically qualified to meet the requirements of military service. So you would actually slow mobilization. You would make it harder to meet the threat, whatever it is. So
right.
for that reason alone, it's administratively unworkable. And how do we know that we would only have a tiny number who would be qualified? Well, look at the research done by the United States Marine Corps in recent years. For 3 years, 2013 to 2015, they did field tests. They had all male units, pitted them against mixed gender units. And guess what? The all male units prevailed 69% of the time. We saw double and higher injury rates among the women in the mixed gender units. There was problems with all sorts of things, attrition, health problems, the kinds of things that led the commandant at the time, General Joseph Dunford, to ask for exemptions, not to have women in the infantry. Well, he was overruled. This was the Obama administration. He was overruled, and now we do have women in the infantry, and we do have them even in special forces. We've had a few women pass in Ranger training. But the physical differences remain the same, and how do we know that? Well, the Army changed their combat fitness test, and they pretended that it would be gender neutral, or they tried to make it gender neutral. The problem is that starting right from the beginning, 84% of the women were failing compared to 30% of the men. So they made some adjustments, and the failure rate was, you know, came down somewhat, but it is still a dramatic difference. Women serve very well in the military. We know they're very strong and capable, but they are not the physical equals of men. when you're talking about having marches under load for miles at a time, the kind of things that are common in the infantry, and the infantry is the largest branch of service in both the Army, the largest community, I should say, in the Army and the Marine Corps. So this is where the need would be greatest.
And typically, when you're calling up a draft, it's typically done for the infantry. Not exclusively, but it's typically done for infantry, yeah.
Right. So why would we deliberately set up a system knowing that we would have to induct and test to find out who's qualified and who isn't great numbers of men and women, not just the few who made it through Ranger training. We're talking about average people, average young men, average young women, not superstars, and we're going to train them to become part of a military force to defend America at the worst possible time. The whole concept, I'm not even getting into the political turmoil that would ensue in time of national emergency. This is just not a good idea. So some people say, well, it's only fair. Women should, serve the same as men.
Well, I mean, I was going to get into, actually. Again, we're speaking with Lane Donnelly at CMRlink.org. That's the Center for Military Readiness. You go to CMRlink.org, and she's got a great discussion of this here, and I've been actually kind of researching it through CMRlink.org, so please go over there. But there's a couple different arguments here, and I'm going to play the Socratic role here of tossing some questions to you and a couple of challenges and having you walk through that.
Sure.
In the first place, we already have women in the armed services, and they're, like you mentioned, they are actually starting to get into combat type units.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first argument would be, well, is it really that different to get a combat qualified female as it is in these days to get a combat qualified male, given the lack of physical training that most American kids get in schools these days? It's certainly that in itself has been identified as a national security issue at times from the Pentagon, and I think for good reason. But I mean, it's the same sort of process that you're going to have to do with the men too. Is it really that much different if you add women into that?
Well, we know it's different because of the tests that were done. Empirical tests and research, scientific studies, have shown over and over and over again. I could give you multiple pages of studies that have been done in the United States and in other countries that clearly show physical differences between men and women are not imaginary. They are real. And when you're talking about combat duty, where physical strength matters, carrying heavy equipment long distances for long periods of time in all types of weather, if that's the kind of tasks that has to be done, and it is, in a military situation.
Absolutely.
Women do not have an equal opportunity to survive or to help fellow soldiers survive. So you can treat women just like men, but if they are not similarly situated in terms of physical strength, then that really is not equal at all. It's unequal. It's putting an unequal burden on the backs of women, and it really, there's nothing fair about it. But remember, it's not about fairness. This issue is about military readiness, the ability to mobilize quickly in a time of national peril. And it's not about fairness. And I started to say that some people think, well, it's only fair now that women are in the infantry. Yes, everybody, all women should be subject to conscription, registration for selective service conscription. But some people believe, or they have this understanding or this just assumption, if women are not subject to registration, then they don't do anything in the military. Nothing could be further from the truth.
Yeah.
Women serve in the military. They always have volunteered. They certainly would do so again. And it's in the future, and it's kind of an insult to suggest that women would not step up to volunteer to serve.
Absolutely.
As they always have, and they always will. I think that's a pretty safe bet. And in fact, I did some research many years ago to find out, was there a gap, say, in medical fields between what was needed and the numbers of volunteers who stepped up, the gap was very small. After 9/11, the president, President George W. Bush, did not issue a call for volunteers for the military at that time. I wish that he had. I recommended that to the National Commission, and they made that one of their recommendations. The first thing that the president should do is ask for volunteers. It's a good idea, right? There's no need for conscription. And if there is a need for conscription, it should be done in the most efficient way possible,
right,
so that we can have fast mobilization and not be bringing in equal numbers of men and women as if they are all equal, but they're not physically equal. That creates a problem that we don't need.
We are speaking with Elaine Donnelly and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. We're going to take a quick break here. And by the way, just To make a comment about that last, if you're calling people up for armed services through an involuntary draft, it had better be for emergency purposes, and that's the last. That you don't need that type of social engineering in those sorts of situations. We're going to talk about that after the break. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew Mariani. We'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
We'll connect you to some clarity. This is the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
More
on demand on the Relevant Radio app.
It's 49 minutes past the hour. I'm Ed Morrissey of HotAir.com, filling in for Drew and taking your calls at 888-914-9149. Don't forget Cale Clark coming up at the top of the hour, The Seven Sorrows and Seven Joys of Mary. Be sure to stay tuned for that. We are speaking with Elaine Donnelly of CMRLink.org. That's the Center for Military Readiness, and talking about the proposals to create. It's actually a couple of proposals. One is to create a universal national service, a requirement for universal national service. The other is to include women in the draft. These are two separate but related proposals that are coming through Congress right now in the 2022 NDAA. That's a defense bill, as Elaine very simply calls it. NDAA is just the technical term for it. It's just the defense bill.
Right.
And we're speaking
the authorization
about
bill. There's a separate appropriations bill.
That's
where
right,
the money
yes.
comes in. But they're both major pieces of legislation, huge bills, and they pass every year. And here we have a proposal to not only include women in selective service registration, but to change the purpose of selective service from what it has been traditionally since its beginning, and that is to replace persons who fall in battle. That's the only reason that we should activate a selective service draft. It's a pretty limited reason, and thank God we haven't had to activate selective service not many times in our history, certainly not in many decades. But if we change it to say that you can be called up for any reason, starting with the military, they've very cleverly said in the language, well, this is to meet mobilization needs, except who gets to decide what the mobilization needs are? Well, federal bureaucrats, that's who. And if you look at the balance, all the other proposals that are coming up in different committees in Congress, the idea is to set up a national council at the cabinet level called the Council on Military, National, and Public Service that would be empowered to commandeer the lives of young people, to direct where they would go. They say this is not going to be mandatory, but of course it will end up being mandatory eventually and incrementally, because it would have a system of carrots and sticks. If you do what the government wants, you get the carrot. If you don't, you get the stick. No matter what it is that they want people to be working at the direction of the government. And again, don't assume that if you work for a pro-life group or your community church projects or things like that, good community-based volunteer service, that probably won't count. Because if the government doesn't direct it, it doesn't count. And so with a series of the carrots and sticks, this is pretty much how it would work out incrementally. Now, isn't it ridiculous? Here we are talking about something pretty monumental. And some of your listeners may not have even heard that this was even going on.
Right.
And that's not right. There should have been public and open debate on this national service idea. And it shouldn't be done in the middle of a big, fat defense bill where nobody is paying any attention. It's just kind of slipped in an incremental way. And it works this way. If you do something incrementally, incrementalism plus consistency equals radical change. And it sneaks up on you because you don't see every step as it goes along. But I've been tracking this issue now for many years. It's not just Draft Our Daughters. Draft Our Daughters is a very key part of it. But Draft Our Daughters is only the wedge to open the door to national service.
Right. And, I often will hear people say, well, look, Israel does this. Israel does both. But they actually don't, first off. And secondly, Israel's a much different situation than the United States.
Right. What Israel does is because they are under constant threat.
Exactly.
They're surrounded by potential enemies. And yes, everybody must serve in some way. However, women in the Israeli military are patrolling the borders in safe areas, borders that are with neighboring countries that are not enemies. They are not involved in combat against the enemy. So it's a big difference. The United States military does things no other military in the world does in quite the way that we do. Our potential adversaries, of course, don't fool around with social agendas and equity and equality, supposedly, in selective service or anything else. They don't do that. Only our military does this. And there is a price to be paid, because if you slow down mobilization, if you make the job more difficult or more dangerous, people can end up getting killed unnecessarily. This and national security can be threatened, because ultimately the all-volunteer force is there to defend the country. And if we had a conscripted force, it would still be there to defend the country under the worst possible circumstances. And we need to go about it in a way that we end up winning, not having catastrophic things happen that leave us at a serious disadvantage. We don't want to see that in our future.
Well, Elaine, I had a friend who once famously observed that the purpose of the military really only has two purposes, which is to kill people and break things.
Mm-hmm.
And anything that deviates from that is going to deviate from the efficiency and the readiness of that military. Now, I think
it also exists to deter aggression.
Well, but it deters through the fact that it's ready to kill people and break things. I mean,
right,
that's,
exactly. If we say the military exists to promote diversity and inclusion and equity and critical race theory, if that's the purpose of the military, then other nations rightfully would say, well, maybe this nation is no longer prepared to defend itself as it has previously. That kind of a conclusion can invite aggression in a way that we don't want to see. And right now, we're very vulnerable in the aftermath of what has happened in Afghanistan, far more vulnerable than anyone ever expected at this time last year. And it's really a shame that we have to go through this, but we certainly don't want to make things worse.
Let's go to the phones. Tom from Madison, Wisconsin, wants to join the conversation. And first off, let me say thank you for your service, Tom.
Of course. So good evening to everybody. I'm Catholic, so I'm on your side. I was in the Marines, active duty, in the 1990s. While listening to your show, I went through the MOS list. That's the Military Occupational Specialty list.
Mm-hmm.
And so with just two exceptions, I think that women could do all of the jobs. And the reason why I'm saying that is, and they pushed this early on us, so being in the military isn't like a physical, brutal thing. It's a thinking person's game. And as far as like meeting the most brilliant people in my life to date, I've met more brilliant women than I have brilliant men. And that's across the board. So you could separate out maybe the infantry and the artillery, but I think that every other job that is available, women could do, and then they could do an equal job or even, beat out their male counterparts. And
well,
so again, I was in the Marines. The Army would be a similar situation, but the Navy and the Air Force and the Coast Guard, and I'm not making any jokes, they don't have those types of jobs. So again, I think that women could do all of those.
Well,
Tom,
now,
the other thing
about
the military
is,
service.
I'm gonna have to cut the call off, Tom, because we've only got a couple minutes left, and I want to give Elaine a chance to respond. But Tom, thank you for your service, and thank you for the call. It's a great call.
Yes, yep. Women are indeed serving in many most MOSs now. The Marines narrowed it down to about 10 before the final order was given to open up everything, including the infantry and special operations forces. However, in those units, those are the tip of the spear, women are at a disadvantage. And even though a few have made it through Ranger School, that doesn't mean that on average women are the physical equals of men. So we need to have women in the military. Of course we do. They will always serve as I believe they will always serve as they are right now. But we're talking about conscription of great numbers of young people who are not volunteers and who are not as prepared as theory would have it. We're talking about reality here, and there's no good justification for including women in this kind of a pool. But that, of course, the door is open for everyone to volunteer.
Right. I mean, I think that, and that's the distinction, right, is that we're not talking about closing these opportunities out for women, because we don't want to do that. I mean, our previous guest, Gretchen Smith, is an Air Force veteran, and she does great work. But the point is that women who volunteer should be absolutely encouraged. But if you're in a national crisis situation where you have to replenish infantry ranks as fast as possible, which is really what the purpose of the draft is, does it help or hurt that mission to include women in it? And what you're arguing at Center for Military Readiness is that it hurts that mission.
It does. It would create an administrative burden that would slow the process, that would increase the time when time is of the essence, when people are dying on the battlefield, for heaven's sakes. Some people say, oh, that'll never happen. We don't know whether that will happen or not.
But if it does, Elaine,
we need to do it the right way.
We're going to have to leave it at that. Elaine Donnelly, CMRlink.org. I'm Ed Morrissey, filling in for Drew. Stay tuned for Cale Clark.